How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. There are people in this world whose work is shaped not only by what they've studied, but by what they've experienced and lived. Meg Forer is one of those people. Growing up in Johannesburg during apartheid, a time of deep division, complexity, and systemic injustice, Meg's early life was set against a backdrop that asked big questions about humanity, connection, and care. Raised in a close-knit family, with the influence of a grandfather who was a missionary, her world was one where purpose, service, and reflection were quietly woven into everyday life. And perhaps it's here, in those early years, that the seeds were planted for a life dedicated to understanding people, especially our smallest, most vulnerable. Meg is an occupational therapist, an internationally recognised author, and the founder of ParentSense, a pioneering platform bringing science-backed practical support to parents navigating the early years of their child's life. Her career has taken her across continents, from New York to Cape Town, working closely with babies and young children, specialising in everything from movement and behaviour to sleep, feeding and emotional development. But what makes Meg's work so deeply resonant is that it doesn't just come from textbooks or clinics. As a mother of three, she found herself standing in the exact same space as so many parents, holding knowledge, yet still navigating the uncertainty, exhaustion, and the profound responsibility of raising a child. From that intersection of science and real life came her best-selling book, Baby Sense. First published in 2002, has become a trusted guide for parents around the world. That work has since grown into a suite of books, including Sleep Sense and Feeding Sense. And now, Parent Sense, a tech-driven platform designed to make expert guidance accessible, practical, and deeply human. Through her podcast, her writing, and her work, Meg has helped shape the way we understand early childhood, reminding us that the first years of life are not just milestones, but about connection, attunement, and the foundations of who we become. Meg, that's exactly where I'd love to begin, is with your childhood. How did your life in South Africa shape the foundation of who you are today?
I do think I grew up with a real sense of the disparities and the inequalities and the unfairness of apartheid. In actual fact, there were a couple of incidents that happened to me myself as well that I can recall. So, yeah, I think that would definitely put a kind of a veneer on who I am. My mum is was a full-time mom, so she was, you know, at home. She was also a teacher. And I think her life mission was to transmit information to us. I think it still is. She was a real educator. So I grew up in a very enriched environment in terms of kind of thoughts and thinking about things, challenging things. I guess that wired who I am today.
You have also experienced your own parenting journey. So how did your experience as a child being parented influence the way you parent today?
So my dad was one of those people who just always showered praise on us. He was incredible. He's a real encourager. And so he always was telling me how fabulous I was, how I could be absolutely anything. And I do think that that is the voice that sits in my head, Kim. I don't feel like there's a ceiling at all. I've always felt like the world is my oyster and I can go anywhere I want to, which I think that was wired from my father. And interestingly, my grandmother was a midwife and my aunt was a midwife. midwife. So both of those, I mean, and I often think back on them. I think for me, my calling has been 100% to touch babies' lives. It's just, it's all I've ever wanted to do. It is completely behind the mission in my business, behind every book I've written. And I think that must have somehow come down from my grandmother and my aunt, but I don't recall that ever being an explicit conversation. So I've got three kids. I started pretty young. So my son is now 26. I've got a daughter who's 24 and then or 25, and then a daughter who is 21 this year, going to be 21 this year. So I've got three older children.
Given your experience as a child, did parenting come easy to you?
No, because parenting doesn't come easy to anyone. It is, you know, anybody who tells you that parenting was a cinch is either in their 50s, 60s and has forgotten, or they're on social media and only giving the world the best view of life. Because the reality is, I don't believe that parenting just comes easily to anyone. I think it's always hard. And I think that's driven by a couple of factors. One is that we have and it doesn't matter who you are, which social echelon you're in, we all want more for our children than we had for ourselves. So we have this deep sense of responsibility to take this child, this human life, and give them something better than we gave ourselves. And that carries huge responsibility. So when you've got that level of responsibility, that's the first thing that sets you up for feeling like it's tough, because you know, it's a big job. And the second thing is, and this is particularly pertinent in the Western world and the global North and maybe in more modern cultures, is that we don't have a family that's connected in, you know, a village. And so we live in these little nuclear units where we're expected to parent pretty much on our own. And in the early days, that's really tough. Most women have never seen an aunt or a mother breastfeed. So how are they supposed to know how to do it? Most of us, you know, have never seen what it's like to manage a toddler temper tantrum. We may have been the toddler, but we haven't been in it. And so that incredible skill of co-regulation is not necessarily something we've seen modeled for us. So yeah, I don't think for anybody, parenting is just an easy journey if they're true with themselves.
You mentioned that you were destined to touch babies' lives. So how did you end up in the occupational therapy realm?
So I knew I always wanted to work with little ones, and I knew I wanted to be in one of the helping professions. And I think for a while I wanted to be a medical doctor. And I think, you know, there are definitely people in your lives that direct you in a certain direction for good or for bad. In this particular case, maybe it was for good, but for a long time I felt it was for bad. And that was that our GP, who'd known me, he'd actually delivered me when I was a baby. When I went to him to say, would you write me a kind of a letter to the medical school in Johannesburg to say that I should be, you know, get into medicine, it was always difficult to get in. He said, no, I don't think that's a good profession for women. And he said, rather go into one of the allied health professions, nursing, physio, OT. And, you know, I at the time, I accepted the rationale because he said, do you want to be a mother? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, then medicine, you know, you can't be a doctor if you want to be a mother. And at the time I accepted it. I mean, obviously what I know now and what we're seeing globally is that there are more females coming through medicine and make incredible doctors. And so maybe my journey should have been different, but I do think that what I've been able to do, maybe I wouldn't have been able to do if I was a doctor, you know. So OT was where I ended up. OT is an interesting profession because it's actually remarkably similar to engineering in that you are taught more about how to problem solve function than you are taught about dysfunction or almost like physical techniques of things like massage and so on, which you would learn in physio. In OT, you are taught how to solve a problem because everything about OT is about function. So if you're an OT working in psychiatry, you're looking at how do we get somebody who's got a psychiatric condition, a diagnosis, to be functional in the job they have or in their marriage? How do we get somebody who has got alcoholism, you know, or who has postnatal depression? So all of these things stand in the way of function. And as an OT, we are taught how to create function. And we do that through a variety of different tools. And of course, my app is a direct extension of that. It is a real OT technique in that I've worked out how to meet people at their problem, improve their function, and I do it through technology.
You began with children up to 12 and then decided to focus more on the 0 to 3 category. How did that then become the catalyst for what you're doing today?
You know, it happened in one session, and I can remember it like it was yesterday. It was a little boy. Let's just call him Charlie. His name began with a C. And I had done an assessment of him. He was 6 years old, and he had some very severe social emotional difficulties. He couldn't function in a classroom. He was extremely difficult to manage and had been a complete nightmare from the day he was born. He was one of those very, very, very tricky babies. And I remember sitting in the consultation room with Charlie's mom, and I was giving her some feedback on him. And she said, well, where did this come from? And I said, well, let's draw this journey. And I started to show her what had happened on day one in the labor room, what had happened in week six, what had happened in week 6 months old, what happened when he was a toddler, how he handled breastfeeding, how he handled bottle feeding, how he handled weaning, sleep, and so on, potty training. And she looked at me and she said to me, I don't understand. If you OTs know this and knew it all the way from the beginning that these were signs of what was to come, why weren't you intervening then? And it was kind of that lightning bulb moment. I was about 2 years into private practice at the time. And I was like, yeah, if I can track this from birth, then I need to get involved at birth. And immediately overnight, my practice shifted. By the time I came back after the December holidays, that was at the end of my second year of private practice, I had pivoted my practice into just focusing increasingly on younger and younger babies. And so that became where I sat for the next kind of 5 years of my private practice. Moms with very colicky babies, moms with babies with sleep problems, moms with babies with weaning problems, developmental delays, social emotional disorders. In toddler years, they would bring their babies to me. So it was very early on in my career that I pivoted into little ones.
What role did becoming a parent and having your own children play in the development of the processes and systems you now employ for others?
So what's really interesting is up until that point, I'd always been focused on the on dysfunction. So bring me a baby with dysfunction and I'll help you to create some function around the baby and the mom. Then I have my own babies. So my own babies are typically developing. There were no, I mean, James didn't have, he, my firstborn, didn't have any more colic than the next baby, didn't have any more sleep navigation difficulties than the next baby. You know, so they were typically developing babies. And yet I could go and dip into my toolbox that I had used with my dysfunctional babies, and I could adjust it to him. And so I would say things to my husband like, you know, James is becoming overstimulated. Less is more. If we settle him to sleep now, because he's had 45 minutes of awake time, he won't have colic this evening. And so I had this kind of conversation that I would have with my husband. And then I have my second baby. And at that time, there was a woman, in fact, it was during the course of my first baby, there was a woman in the UK called Gina Ford. And she'd written this book called The Contented Little Baby Book. And it was the most rigid, regimented, routine focused book imaginable. And it just pushed me into a complete decline because she was putting out there this perfect map for a baby's day. And my baby wasn't doing that, but he was typically developing. And I realized that, and that created more anxiety. So I realized that actually there was a different way to do it. And that if we understood why babies were behaving the way they were, we could then give them what we call a responsive routine. And we could respond to them differently. We could engage with them differently. And so eventually when my second baby was coming along, Philip said to me, you've got to write this all down. And so over the course of my second baby's first year of life, I wrote the book while she was a baby. And that was the book Baby Sense. It was published at the end of her first year. It came out a couple of months later. And that became an overnight bestseller. It was very unexpected from me. But it just resonated with moms because for the first time, they understood why their baby was doing what they should do and what they should be doing on that basis rather than trying to follow a script.
It's funny, you know, because one of the most common sayings I hear is that babies don't come with a manual, but it sounds like you've written one. It's something that I know many people could use. How do you elevate that message and get this out there? Because it's so important.
So Baby Sense is globally distributed. So anyone who is looking to get hold of it can get it. I know it is in Australia. It's been translated into, I think, six languages. It is also available in our app. So we have an app called Parent Sense, which you can get on the App Store. And if you go to the book section of the app, you can actually download the ebook as well. You know, it's interesting. You said I wrote the manual. You know, I think because every baby is so different, there can't be a manual. Like it can't exist. But what can exist is an interpretation guideline. So it's almost like I gave moms the language, like the Duolingo of babies, and then they then had to make it their own. And I think that for me is very important. And it resonates deeply with us, particularly with modern moms, where, you know, they don't want a manual. They don't want to be told what to do. They want the principles and then to go for it themselves. And that's exactly what the book does do.
What's the most common challenge you think that modern parents face in relation to babies in that category 0 to 3 or 0 to 5?
I think the most painful challenge that they suffer is sleep deprivation. It's just like, I mean, it's on another level. Nobody tells you what it's going to be like. And now you're supposed to do this most important job of your life and you're going to do it in a sleep deprived state. So I think nobody prepares you for that. Certainly I wasn't prepared for it. So I think that's a universal challenge. And it's also a challenge that's gone across generations. This is not necessarily a new thing. Although I do think that a couple of things have set us up for it being a little bit more impactful now, or, you know, a little bit more devastating now. The one is that women carry a massive load outside the home generally now. It's very rare for a woman to be at home or sitting under a tree for hours every day and not actually running a business, get back to work quickly, having some sort of side hustle. It's very unusual. So there's an enormous amount of pressure on moms now, which I don't think existed 50 or 60 years ago. I think things are very different now in that respect. So you layer sleep deprivation on top of the drama of the world. It's hard for moms. The second thing that I think is very hard, which is unique to this time that we live in, is the impact of social media. And I think that women now carry a burden from society to be perfect, to do it well, to execute as well as her best friend. And remember, her best friend on social media is only posting the good stuff. She's not posting the shit stuff. And so, you know, it's really, really hard. And nobody really always acknowledges that. And when they do, even that feels like they are acknowledging the hard stuff for the attention and the clicks and the engagement on social media rather than acknowledging it because it resonates with them, you know. So I think it's a very hard time to bring up children now. So I think those two things for me would be the two things that, you know, are really, really tough, big pain points for parents.
As an occupational therapist, you would have seen a lot of things in delayed speech, delayed movement, milestone delays. There has been an incredible rise in ADD, ADHD, and autism diagnoses over the last decade, and particularly the last 5 years. From your experience over the last couple of decades, what do you put that down to? I mean, what are you noticing about the differences in children and how they're wired so differently neurologically?
Wow. Okay. Very good question. So first of all, I do think that some neurodiversity is genetic. And so it is there and it just was always there and it's never been diagnosed. So we're getting better at diagnosing it. We're more sensitive to it. We're more accepting of diagnoses. In some countries in the world, you're likely to get more services if your child is diagnosed. So people seek out diagnoses so they can get more support at school. So there's definitely an increase in diagnosis. There is no doubt. And there are people that are saying, you know, kind of everything's been thrown under the autism diagnosis, which previously would have maybe been cognitively challenged or, you know, just maybe tricky behavior, whatever. So diagnoses are, and they become faddy. So there's some, you know, very faddy diagnoses that are doing the rounds. So position that as number one. Position number two would be environmental impacts. I do think that environmentally, there are things that our children are exposed to that we never were, from pesticides to certain insecticides, proton pump inhibitors, which are things to stop reflux for little babies, antibiotics. There are things that shift our gut microbiome from pregnancy, shift our baby's gut microbiome, and certainly through breastfeeding, the weaning journey, and the foods that we expose to, the creams we put on our babies, things like phthalates and perfumes in baby creams. There is something environmental. So I don't think anybody can escape that. There is something environmental for sure. And that's hard environmental toxins that I'm talking about. And then the third thing, which I think potentially is maybe the most devastating or certainly the most compounding of on the other two, is the way that we engage with our children. Children's brains are socially wired to connect. And on the day a baby's born, they will actually seek out the figuration of a face, two eyes and a mouth, as an example. They'll actually seek that out. So they're socially wired. What happens in the first 2 years of life, though, is that, and particularly in our modern world, is that parents are missing those signals. There is something called technoference, which is basically when a mom holds her phone, looks at her phone, and is immediately removed from her baby's world, emotional world. And when a baby sees enough of that, enough of looking at the top of their parent's head, or enough of a mom missing their signals, or enough of a parent who doesn't know how to co-regulate and to help their child find their self-regulation, it starts to interfere with the ability to actually self-regulate emotions, mood, social engagement, behavior, and emotions. And so we've got this terrible trajectory that we're seeing transferring onto babies because of a lack of engagement. We don't know how to play anymore. We're using too much technology. We're giving babies technology. And that whole kind of perfect storm is setting little ones up for some social, emotional, environmental difficulties, which then later on then go and get diagnosed as, you know, neurodiversity.
There's been a big push since Jonathan Haidt's book, The Anxious Generation, about removing screens from children, something that's quite difficult because it's the art of distraction. And I know as a mother, anytime you could get some time, and I used to use the television or a video for my children, they were selected by me. You know, how do you propose, as busy modern day parents, we try to reconnect with our children and be more conscious about what we're actually modeling?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, sitting in the position that I am, having written books and been seen as a so-called parenting expert, carries a very serious weight around not kind of throwing guilt onto parents. And I'm always super conscious of that, because I can tell you the gold standard: you don't meet it, you feel guilty, you're in this vicious cycle, it's just horrible. And I don't want to go there. But I think there are parameters that parents need to be very, very conscious of. And the tech environment is one of those. It really is. You need to be super careful around how you distract your children with technology, how you use technology, how long they use it for, and what you're showing them. So I always try and give parents the gold standard. And in fact, I'm going to write a book on this one day. It'll be my last book, but there'll be the gold standard and the when shit happens. Like when life really happens, this is what you can default to. And so here's your gold standard on technology: children under two should never see a screen. They just shouldn't. And it's the evidence is unrefuted, and it comes out weekly at the moment about what a tech does to little ones' brains. And it's not just them holding the screen, it's you holding it too. That's called technoference. So that's your gold standard. But we know that life happens. We know it does, because I mean, I've been a mom to three running a business, my first business, Baby Sense. I started it the week my third child was born. So I've run businesses, I understand. And putting on technology for them is often the easiest default. It is the most simple babysitter. So then you've got to follow three principles. The one is that you've got to limit the time. So you've got to be a conscious parent. You have to do that. So you have to say, okay, well, look, we're going to have TV this week, and it's going to happen at these times. It's going to be related to this that's happened in the home, and it's going to give me that back. And you've got to be conscious about it. So limit the time. The second is curate the content, because there is content and then there is content. So something like CoComelon is an absolute toxin for developing brains. And there are a lot of those where, you know, you've got this fast-paced, I mean, I'm telling you now that, and moms don't realize this maybe, parents don't realize this, is that there are scientists sitting behind those screens while they're editing it, working out for the most addictive pathway that they can trigger as babies are watching this, so that they can make sure that it becomes highly engageable content. So, you know, understand that there's content and there's content. And, you know, if you're going to choose between Peppa Pig and CoComelon, choose Peppa Pig. There's a little bit of a story there, you know, and there are other ones. Miss Rachel's lovely. You know, she's at least having a conversation, there's language, there's music, there's maybe some learning. So that's the second thing: curate the content, curb the time, curate the content. And the third thing is watch it with them. Now that of course takes away the babysitter piece, because if you're watching with them, you don't get to do something else. But when we watch something alongside our children, we make sense of it for them, and it does become a learning experience.
I love that. It makes perfect sense to me. And Meg, you're doing everything to make sense of parenting for others. You are a gem, and I hope we can revisit this conversation and explore some other topics. But thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure, Kim. And thank you for your very insightful questions, because you can only give the information if those questions have been well positioned. So thank you.
Meg Forer, founder of Parent Sense, author, and an occupational therapist who has helped people across the world navigate babies and early childhood. A depth of knowledge that's been shaped by years of study, practice, and innovation, but also a willingness to be open, speak honestly about the realities of parenting, the uncertainty we all face, the learning that's available to us, and the moments that don't always go to plan. Because at the heart of this conversation is a simple truth. There is no perfect way to raise a child. But there is a connected way. It asks us to slow down, listen, observe, and respond with intention rather than expectation. This week, I'd love to invite you to build trust, to nurture emotional safety in the children influenced by you, and lay the foundation for a human being who feels seen, supported, and secure in the world. Most importantly, offer that same compassion to yourself as parents, carers, and guides of future generations. If you loved listening to this conversation as much as I loved bringing it to you, then please share it. Explore Meg's work through ParentSense, her books, and her podcast, all of which are dedicated to making parenting feel a little less overwhelming and a lot more connected. You'll find the links in the show notes, along with a way to get involved and learn more. Until next time, let's be the change we want to see in the world, because the way we support each other is part of what we teach our children too.